I'm actually really proud of everybody that's been involved and very excited for the kids that they can relax this year and not be crammed.
A creative solution to a crowded school in Nanwalek. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, September 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, at President Obama's last Tribal Nations Conference, he remembers his Alaska visit.
The students at the middle school in Dillingham, Alaska, taught me a traditional Yopik dance.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
A state superior court judge is allowing a Matanuska-Susitna Borough marijuana vote to go forward. Earlier today, Judge David Zwink in Palmer issued an order allowing the October 4th ballot initiative on a borough ban against commercial marijuana to stay on the ballot. Two lawsuits filed against the borough this month asked the courts to force the borough to take Proposition B1 off the borough ballot. In today's action, Zwink also combined both lawsuits, in which the plaintiffs allege that the borough acted illegally in placing the initiative before voters. Matsu Borough Attorney Nicholas Spiropoulos has made the judge's order public, although he says he is offering no comment at this time. In his order, Judge Zwink says it would be disruptive to the election process to remove Proposition B1 from the ballot because absentee ballots have already been sent out and borough election brochures have been published. The judge's order allows the Matsu vote to proceed while it places a hold on action on the combined cases until after borough election results are in. President Barack Obama addressed his final White House Tribal Nations Conference today. The most famous Yupik singer on Facebook, Byron Nikolai of Tuksuk Bay, welcomed Obama to the stage. Obama said it was a privilege over his 8 years in the White House to spend time with Native people and to visit more tribal communities than any prior president. In citing a few Alaska examples, he tripped on pronunciation, but the crowd didn't mind.
My staff still talks about all the wonderful people in Kotzebue, Alaska, who tried to, they tried to teach them Inupiaq, and tried to stuff them full of meat at Caribou Fest.
The Tribal Nations Conference, now in its 8th year, was something Obama started, and it set the tone for his White House. The conference brings hundreds of Native leaders to Washington and gives them a chance to meet top officials in federal government. Another way Obama elevated Native issues was by creating the White House Council of Native American Affairs. He describes it as a permanent institution with cabinet-level focus. Obama says the young people he's met gave him confidence there's more progress ahead.
The students at the middle school in Dillingham, Alaska, taught me a traditional Yopik dance.
Somebody shouted, "Show us."
Well, I can only do it when they're around, because I'm basically just watching them.
The Obama White House also launched an annual conference for Native youth, which begins tomorrow. Doyon, the Fairbanks and Interior Alaska Native Regional Corporation, was in federal court in Washington, D.C. today, trying to keep the discount it was to get almost 2 years ago when it bid billions of dollars on Spectrum, a portion of the public airwaves reserved for wireless broadband. The discount is worth nearly $2 billion. But after the auction concluded in January of 2015, the Federal Communications Commission ruled that Doyon's company, Northstar, wasn't entitled to the 25% discount intended for very small businesses.
And they changed the rules after the fact, and that was what we were arguing against today.
Sarah Obed, Doyon's vice president of external affairs, spoke outside the courthouse. Doyon, Alaska's largest private landowner, wouldn't seem to be a very small business, but then-Senator Ted Stevens helped create the spectrum auction, and thanks to him, there's an exemption that allows Alaska Native corporations to qualify as small. The issue, as the FCC sees it, is Doyon's heavyweight partner, Dish Network. Dish owns an 85% stake in North Star. Doyon owns a portion of the remaining 15%. But Sarah Obed says Doyon is running the show.
Dish Network does not manage North Star Wireless. We do. And so that's something we're really proud of.
The FCC, though, says Dish is more than a passive partner because, among other things, it loaned North Star most of the nearly $6 billion it bid in the auction. Dish has contracts to build and operate the network, and according to their business agreement, North Star and Doyon can't transfer their rights or raise capital elsewhere without Dish's consent.
To be frank, I'm appalled that a corporate giant has attempted to use small business discounts to rip off American taxpayers.
That's Federal Communications Commissioner Azit Pai on the Dish-Doyon deal at a Senate hearing last year. Today's case was heard by a three-judge panel of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a family works to support and understand their child's gender identity.
As long as he's happy, she's happy, Rusty's happy, that's all that matters. And to me, Rusty appears to be very happy.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GCI, serving more than 100 Alaska communities. GCI's Alaska Born and Raised campaign celebrates the people who call Alaska home. GCI.com/share your story. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
The Iditarod Trail Committee announced today that former champion Lance Mackey has withdrawn from the race, citing health reasons. The committee shared the news through its Facebook page, saying Mackey is on a, quote, journey to improving his health. Mackey is a cancer survivor and has had a difficult time in the last two Iditarods, scratching last year midway through the race. The Mushers' four back-to-back wins in both the Iditarod and Yukon Quest make him one of the most elite long-distance mushers in the sport's history. Calls to Mackey's comeback kennel in Fairbanks went unanswered this afternoon. There are currently 54 mushers signed up for the 2017 Iditarod. Nanwalek School is getting some relief from overcrowding after a garage shop area was converted into a new classroom over the summer. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has the story.
Nanwalek School Principal Nancy Klein says the new classroom for 6th through 12th graders has made students more comfortable and enthusiastic about learning.
The kids at Nanwalek School just seem really happy to come to school this year. We have a pretty large middle school group, 26 kids, and I believe there's 17 high school kids, and that room is so much more appropriate for them. So they now have two large rooms, one downstairs and one upstairs for their classes.
Nanwalek is an Aleutic Sugpiak community near the southern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. Klein says the room is being used to teach middle and high school science and math. The school was built before statehood by the Bureau of Indian Affairs in 1958. There's been no expansion since an addition in 1977. But the population of Nanwalek has continued to grow. According to census data, Nanwalek's population has nearly doubled since the state started keeping track in 1990. Last year, the school was at 138% capacity. Until the Kenai Peninsula School District helped the school convert the garage shop into a classroom, students were packed into a building that's supposed to hold just 60. Klein says enrollment is up this year and that she expects continued growth.
There is definitely a growth pattern going on. I'm not sure that in the next couple of years we're going to see any big increase, but I think we're going to see another bump down the road.
Klein says she's happy the district has found this temporary solution.
I'm actually really proud of everybody that's been involved and very excited for the kids that they can relax this year and not be crammed.
Klein says the school has 80 students this year. At this time, the Kenai Peninsula Borough School District has no plans to expand the school. In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska's privately owned electric utilities can't increase their rates overnight. They first have to go through a process with the state's regulatory commission to demonstrate a need. That's what Juneau's utility, AELNP, is at the beginning stages of doing. But customers get little say about projects already on the books. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
Last week, Alaska Electric Light and Power announced Juneau residents could expect to pay 8% more on their electric bills by the end of 2017, pending approval from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska, or RCA. The community's last rate increase was 6 years ago, after a new hydro project was built.
A lot happens in that amount of time.
Like investments of over $50 million, according to Debbie Driscoll, AELNP's vice president. Since 2010, she says the company spent money on improvements to its transmission lines, substation upgrades, and most visibly, a new $22 million backup diesel plant.
Which is less than half of the $50 million that we've invested over the last 6 years. In addition to those capital investments, we also just have increased costs.
Driscoll says that comes from normal inflation, and it was necessary to build the diesel plant to avoid rolling blackouts in case of emergency, like an avalanche. The utility is proposing increasing Juneau rates in phases, first this November by nearly 4%, and again next year by about another 4%. Essentially, the way it works for the state's privately held utilities is build now, ask for a rate increase later.
You have to pay for everything up front, all the infrastructure, and so the Regulatory Commission allows utilities to recover that over time.
Driscoll doesn't think the utility typically earns everything back. Still, compared to most other states, the order this happens in is unusual. And in Alaska, it can look like putting the cart before the horse. Or in this case, the diesel plant and capital improvements before a final say on a rate increase.
That's a specific construct that the legislature has created.
That's Bob Pickett, a commissioner at Alaska's regulatory authority. He says in lots of other places, electric utilities have to submit a plan before spending money on projects. That plan can include things like current and projected load growth, how much power will be used over time, community input, and ways to reduce the overall cost. But here, that conversation happens afterwards, at least publicly, and it always has.
So it sounds like it's always been like this.
Pretty much, yeah.
There is a process of checks and balances. Privately owned utilities, like AELNP, have to go through hearings with the state's regulatory commission to establish a need for steeper electric rates.
It's like a trial. Yes, that's probably a way to think about it.
Pickett says it takes over a year to reach a final decision on a permanent rate increase. As it currently stands, Debbie Driscoll from AELNP says Juneau's electric rates are below the national average. And if the regulatory authority approves a full 8%, she says the capital city would only be slightly above that. It's an increase of nearly $7 a month for an average customer in the summer.
And an increase of $8 a month during the winter rates.
Comments are open on the rate increase until October 20th. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Southeast Alaska has seen economic growth in the last 5 years, but that growth could soon be stalled by state budget cuts. That was the message shared at the annual Southeast Conference meeting in Petersburg last week. Angela Denning reports from member station KFSK in Petersburg.
By nearly all accounts, Southeast Alaska has seen growth in recent years. An annual economic report shows people coming to the region in droves. In the last 5 years, the population has grown by 4%. Jobs have grown by 4%. Job earnings have increased by 16%. And passenger arrivals by plane, ferry, and cruise ships has increased by 15%.
But all of that doesn't mean anything, unfortunately, because we have the fiscal contraction of the state budget.
That's Melanie Shivens with Raincoast Data. She was presenting the information to a few hundred attendees at the Southeast Conference. According to the annual report, if it wasn't for the state government's impending fiscal meltdown, the region would be well-positioned for a prosperous future.
We have so many bright spots in our private sector economy. We have lots of great indicators, and they're going the right way.
Over the last 5 years, Southeast has added over 2,700 people and 2,000 jobs. Government makes up more than a third of the jobs. The seafood industry employs 12%, followed by tourism at 9%. But state jobs in the region are expected to decrease by 200 positions in the first half of 2017. 500 other state jobs were lost in Southeast over the last couple of years.
The reduced spending at the state, it doesn't just impact state jobs. There's so many businesses out there that have most of their contracts and most of their employees working to serve state government, either on state government contracts, providing services to the state. So the impacts of the loss of these jobs and the loss of state dollars in the Southeast Alaska economy is going to be very significant.
Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott is the keynote speaker at the Southeast Conference. He and the administration have long been touting the need for a state fiscal plan to address much lower oil revenue.
I think it's important for all of us to realize that at this point, it is a self-inflicted storm.
Mallott blames the legislature for not putting a fiscal plan in place amidst a multi-billion dollar budget deficit. He says we don't just need different revenue sources, but a different core economy. And he believes local communities will continue to be hit.
We are essentially visiting the result upon local government because these services have to be met. And if the state doesn't do them, in many respects, core services will be demanded by local citizens of their local governments.
Mallott is optimistic, though, that lawmakers will find solutions in the 2017 session. Meanwhile, tourism in Southeast has been growing. Last year, the region broke the record for number of people arriving by airplane. But Shivan says a reduction in the state's tourism marketing budget could impact the industry. It was $18 million in 2015, but it's been whittled down to $1.5 million for this fiscal year. One silver lining in government job loss is the U.S. Coast Guard. Southeast Alaska is home to 34 communities and more than 1,000 islands. The geography makes travel challenging and often happens on the water, by boats, ferries, and cruise ships. To help keep the area safe, the Coast Guard employs nearly 800 people in the region, a workforce that's increased by 26% in the last 5 years. Those federal jobs should be safe, says Shivans.
Expect to see all sectors of government continue to shed jobs, with the exception of the Coast Guard.
Despite its remote nature, Southeast is a good place to live if you're older, according to statistics. Most of the population growth has come from an increased number of seniors. In the last 5 years, people ages 65 to 80 has increased by 42%.
The average age in Southeast Alaska is 5 years older than the state as a whole.
The state's Department of Labor predicts that one-third of Southeast's population will be over the age of 60 in the next few years. Overall, the Southeast region represents 10% of the state's economy. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. It's no secret that salmon is important to Alaskans. It brings us together across communities, cultures, and economies. Discover what you can do to ensure healthy runs of salmon for generations to come by visiting salmonproject.org/20ways. This message is sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors are mentors and friends on campus and online. UAS.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
The body of a missing hiker was found by searchers in Sitka on Friday afternoon. KCAW's Emily Kwong has more.
Michael Hansen was 37 years old. The avid outdoorsman was reported missing on Monday after he did not return from a solo hiking trip up Mount Verstovia in Sitka. Throughout the week, Sitka Search and Rescue received assistance from the U.S. Coast Guard, U.S. Forest Service, the Alaska State Troopers, the Sitka Police and Fire Departments, and a number of volunteers who combed the mountain for Hansen and provided support to his parents, who arrived in Sitka on Wednesday. At 4:20 p.m. on Friday, a team of volunteers found Hansen at the 1,160-foot level. His body will be transported to the medical examiner in Anchorage to determine cause of death. Search and Rescue Captain Lance Ewers believes Hansen slipped while hiking off-trail on his way down Mount Verstovia.
Instead of staying on the trail, he just decided to go straight down the mountain. And that's what I think happened. It appeared like he fell and slid down, could have been as much as 100 feet, 75 to 100 feet or so. So it was a sad deal.
Ewers said the old-growth forest Hansen was likely cutting through is deceptively steep, and that it's easy to lose your footing. He advises all those hiking and hunting in Sitka to take extra precautions when going off-trail. Hansen was born and raised in Wisconsin. The former Army Ranger moved from Anchorage to Sitka in July of this year. He was a residential counselor at Sitka Counseling and Prevention Services, providing both individual and group counseling. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
Alaska state troopers have identified the hunting guide involved in an Admiralty Island bear mauling last week as 63-year-old Laverne Beyer of Juneau. Authorities say Beyer, a big game hunting guide, was with client Douglas Atkins of Jenkins, Kentucky on Thursday evening on Admiralty Island near Angoon. They startled a brown bear on the beach, which led to a brief attack on Atkins, who the Coast Guard flew to Juneau early Friday for medical treatment for injuries that were not life-threatening. Beyer did not return messages left requesting comment. In 2007, Alaska Department of Fish and Game Information Officer Riley Woodford profiled Beyer in a department news magazine. At the time, Woodford identified Beyer as a fish and game researcher who may have been the most avid bear trapper in Alaska. Woodford wrote he had handled almost 800 bears after 35 years of snaring, darting, and capturing bears and survived 4 bear attacks. The Alaska Department of Commerce lists Beyer's big game guide license as under probation since 2013. State employee directories list Beyer as a current fish and game employee. The American Academy of Pediatrics says most kids have a stable sense of gender identity by the time they are 4. Rusty is one of them. Rusty may have been born a boy, but she knows she is definitely a girl. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has the story.
4-year-old Rusty is really focused.
This is Shopkin, Shopkin, Shopkin poster, Shopkin chopsticks, Shopkin oven.
She rifles Shopkin through a small box of toys in her living room. They're all Shopkins, tiny cartoonish plastic models of food and household items that are plastered with giant eyes and goofy smiles. She excitedly runs into her room and pulls open a drawer filled with them, extracting one of her newest.
It's a bone and her name is Bona.
Even the pink walls are plastered with Shopkin stickers, though she has princess stickers up too. She doesn't only like Shopkins. Rusty's older sister, 7-year-old Lola, says this is a new look for Rusty's room.
Because it's pinkalicious! And I'll tell you what it used to be like. His bed used to be like a pirate bed. The curtains used to be blue, and this used to be like a town carpet.
Rusty says she didn't like the old room. It didn't fit who she was.
I didn't feel comfortable in my bed. That's how it happened.
Rusty didn't feel comfortable in boys' clothing either. So she started stealing things out of Lola's closet. Lola says she was not happy about that because they were her dresses. But as soon as their parents started letting Rusty shop in the girls' department and Rusty left Lola's clothes alone, Lola didn't care.
As long as he's happy, I'll be happy.
That's Jennifer's theory, too. She's the kid's mom. Jennifer says the first time Rusty told her she was a girl was about a year ago.
He corrects us if we call him a boy. Mm-hmm. Like if we say, oh, you're my big boy, he's like, I'm a girl, thanks.
She says at first, Rusty just wanted to play with girls' toys and dress up for fun. Rusty picked a princess cake and Hello Kitty decorations for her 3rd birthday. Jennifer says they didn't think anything of it. Then Rusty started fighting about clothes in the morning. She only wanted to wear dresses and was stealing from Lola. Eventually, Jennifer bought Rusty girl clothing, and the fight stopped. Rusty declared that she is a girl. Jennifer says she and her husband are just going with what seems to be working.
I don't know that there should be a handbook, but there should at least be something easier to navigate through all this.
Jennifer says she's just learning as she goes. Last week, Rusty's pediatrician asked if Rusty preferred he or she. Rusty picked she. Jennifer is still trying to remember to change pronouns. She says It makes her realize she has so many more questions about what to do next.
Do I have to tell people? Like, do I have to announce it to people? Do I want to hear what people have to say about that? Like, I just want to be in my bubble. Like, I'm not sure what to do with that. I've told some of my close friends and they were just like, okay. But then it's like, do I tell the school? Do I tell the daycare? Like, I just, what do you do? Like, I don't know.
When she first started posting photos of Rusty dressed as a girl on her Facebook page, she got mixed reactions. She pulls up an image on her phone, Rusty smiling with boyish short hair and pink girl clothing.
I put this one on Facebook and I got a lot of feedback like, why am I letting him do that? And da da da.
Despite that, Jennifer says she feels like her family is mostly in a safe, protected space. Only one close relative has rejected Rusty for identifying as a girl. But Jennifer worries that it won't always be this easy. That's why we're only using their first names. She knows it's important to talk about this because other people are experiencing it too. But she wants to protect her children. She thinks Rusty might have the same fears.
Just before I told you that you could ask him whatever you want, I said, can Anne ask you about being a girl? And he was like, no. And I said, why? He goes, if I tell her, will she leave?
Rusty never explained why she said that. Jennifer wonders what's next for her child. What will Rusty's school say when she starts kindergarten? Which bathroom will she use? But ultimately, it comes down to just one thing.
As long as he's happy, she's happy, Rusty's happy. That's all that matters. And to me, Rusty appears to be very happy.
Rusty runs past her mom, clothed entirely in pink with a tutu and sparkly wings, radiating confidence. She grabs the microphone and continues our first conversation.
So I have a Shopkin stuffies and I like them and they're pretty and they're gorgeous. But I want to do them.
From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hellman.
Learn more about gender identity during our live community forum, Community in Unity, Being Transgender, on Wednesday at 7 p.m. at Alaska Public Media. Find out more at alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer, Zachariah Hughes, and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Jenkins and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, Ed Schoenfeld and Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline and its operations today and into the future. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The University of Alaska Southeast specializes in you. UAS is a learning community where your professors or mentors and friends on campus and online. uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.